Gershom Gornbrick, how are you?
Good, Glenn. How are you?
Doing well, doing well. Welcome to the Glenn Show, Gershom. You want to introduce yourself a little more formally?
This is Gershom Gornbrick. I'm speaking from Jerusalem. I'm a journalist and historian, the author most recently of The Unmaking of Israel.
And this is Glenn Lowry of Brown University and the Glenn Show. Gershom, good to be talking with you. I am just curious about your take on the American political scene these days from Jerusalem. We've had two political conventions here most recently, and, well, still culminating tonight, the Democratic Convention. Controversy about the Democrats' platform, and one of the themes was mention of Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. I saw a piece of yours on that that I thought was interesting. I wonder if you'd talk about it. And then just more generally, this question of what's going to be driving the Jewish American vote here and the extent to which Israel-related issues play in that from your perspective. I'm just curious about that.
Well, you know, let me mention discuss first what you mentioned about the controversy false balloon about the Democratic platform. I have to admit that the whole controversy struck me as bizarre, because when I first read that the Democrats hadn't said anything about Jerusalem in their platform, I was reassured that for once there was a little bit of integrity, because the usual pattern in American political talk about Israel is particularly campaign talk, seems to be so divorced from the realities here. And if there's anything that's divorced, it's talk about that even implies that the United States is going to recognize Jerusalem formally as Israel's capital, or that discusses Jerusalem as being undivided. The first part of that is, yes, certainly Jerusalem is Israel's capital. This is where the government
just
is.
Just as a matter of fact.
Yeah, I mean, in reality, this is where the government is. This is where the parliament is. Mm-hmm. We have a parliamentary system. The parliament is sovereign. Almost all of the government ministries are here. The prime minister's house is here. The demonstrations against the government in front of the prime minister's house are here. You know, it's where the government is. And I always get a combination of frustration and amusement when I read some foreign news report. I still see this particularly in the British press, but sometimes in the American press as well, that, you know, they want to refer to the Israeli government in the way that you refer to Washington when you want to refer to the United States, they refer to Tel Aviv, and that's like, you know, somebody pretending that, that the American government is in Memphis or something like that, to refer to Tel Aviv as being the capital of Israel. It's silly. On the other hand, there's no chance in the world that an American government is going to formally recognize Jerusalem as the capital or move the embassy here before a peace agreement with the Palestinians. It's, it's Charlie Brown and the football. I mean, they promise it every 4 years, and as soon as somebody actually becomes president, he realizes that, maybe the State Department people sit down and, you know, give him a reality check or something like that, and it becomes obvious to him that if he does that, he will be creating a huge diplomatic flap for no purpose. This intention vanishes. So the fact that the Democrats did not make this promise was refreshing. But then a controversy was created around it, and they wimped out and they added it. So
no sooner had they done something sensible than they were forced by political exigency to revert to form.
Right.
But I have a question for you, right?
You know, the gaffe, which is inadvertently telling the truth, or at least inadvertently not telling a falsehood. So, but I also don't think it will make the slightest bit of difference electorally. So that makes it doubly amusing.
Okay, so let's come to that, the electoral consequences one way or the other. But first, just on this issue of the symbolism about moving embassies and recognizing capitals. So it seems to me you made two points. One was that, as a matter of fact, Jerusalem is the capital of Israel. Just as a matter of fact, it is the capital of Israel. Then the second point you make is that no American administration, Republican, Democrat, or otherwise, who's interested in playing a sensible role in the long-term peace process would peremptorily move the capital or the embassy to Jerusalem without there being, a negotiated settlement. Now, it seems to me that those two observations are kind of like the same point. One of them is that it's a symbolic thing, not a real thing that you're talking about when you talk about the designation. And then the second is it's an important symbolic thing that the Americans wouldn't want to be seen to be violating, because that would send the wrong signal. And it seems to me that that is recognizing that this is all about symbolism and about signaling explains the otherwise inexplicable American political controversy, because it's about signaling commitment to the Zionist enterprise, signaling commitment to Israel as the Jewish homeland, and things of this kind. So it works very powerfully as a symbol. Move the embassy to Jerusalem, recognize Jerusalem as the capital. All of these things are indirect communication of other kinds of values. They're not really about policy.
Well,
does that make any sense to you?
It makes sense to me that there is, I mean, I certainly think that in politics there's a great amount of symbolic action, a great amount of conveying messages in a sort of shorthand. I think that that symbols have a tremendous power for people. If you're talking about Jerusalem, obviously there's tremendous power to symbols. That's what the city is about. That's the only thing, natural resource, that explains Jerusalem being here is symbolism. But in this particular case, it's a misplaced symbol, because you're making a promise that you're not going to keep, which is foolish, and sort of makes a mockery out of the whole process. And there are other ways in which for all due respect to symbolism, there are more realistic ways in which this relationship is expressed. I mean, I'm, more impressed with the fact that President Obama has increased funding for Israeli missile defense than promises that, that won't be kept. My son, who's, into the classics, said to me that, Cicero said that, it's a good thing for a politician to make promises, because nobody will remember when you don't keep them. But if you don't make promises, it's like you're not concerned with the people. All right, so this is very old-fashioned cynicism when politicians make promises that they're not intending to keep. But I think in this case, people remember that every 4 years this promise is made and it's not kept. So, it's an empty symbol, is what I'm saying. And the real symbolism is the real practical thing here is not the symbolism, it's the long-term alliance between the two countries. So,
Well, let me press you on this a little bit. As between Barack Obama and Mitt Romney, is there any, in your view, difference in the extent to which, however unexpressed, those individuals might have sympathies for the Palestinian national aspiration, or a kind of deep recognition of the sort of, historic pain and injury of the Palestinian people, or even a kind of commitment to recognizing and seeing the Palestinians as a people? Do you think? I mean, I'm just asking you.
Okay, look, obviously I cannot.
It's different. And if they did differ, would that be something worth trying to signal about to an electorate?
I obviously can't read their innermost thoughts. I think that when Mitt Romney made his overseas trip a few weeks ago, he showed himself inadvertently to be extremely unskilled at foreign policy. To not be a diplomat. I think that during his visit to Israel, he took an approach which saw support for Israel as a zero-sum game of, if I support Israel, I have to keep my distance from the Palestinians. And I think that in the positions that Mr. Obama has taken since the beginning of his presidential campaign in 2008, he has recognize that this is not a zero-sum game. In other words, a two-state solution is at the same time the opportunity for the Palestinians to achieve independence, and it's the opportunity for the Israelis to wreak peace and to end the unnatural and destructive situation of the occupation, and for that matter even to achieve such small but symbolically important things as international recognition that Jerusalem is Israel's capital. So it's win-win. And I think on a wider level, an emotional level, I think that to the extent that I can read the personalities, Romney has taken sort of a balance sheet approach to politics where, and certainly to the Israeli-Palestinian issue, where it's zero sum. You add here, that means you subtract there. And Obama has taken a, shall we say, political or diplomatic approach in which there are situations in which both sides win and there are situations in which both sides lose. So I think that, yes, he has a greater sense that the current situation is untenable for the Palestinians and also for the Israelis, and that he wanted to reach a solution to that, and he tried hard in his first year and ran into a brick wall and moved on to other things. I can only hope that in his second term, which I hope takes place, that he will be able to he will be in a better position to approach this issue and pursue it more successfully.
So my guess is that that would be a minority view within the Israeli voting public. Am I wrong about that?
You know, I don't know. I mean, I've seen polls of Israeli opinion on Obama versus Romney, and they have as many people who don't express an opinion as the people who express an opinion one way or the other. I think the last poll I saw, there was a slight advantage to Romney. I don't have the numbers in front of me. You also have to remember that part of what's gone on over the last 4 years, three and a half years, is that there's been a series of uncomfortable situations, shall we say, between Obama and Prime Minister Netanyahu.
Yeah, yeah.
Within the Israeli context, there is more than one way to read that. In other words, historically, proper handling of the relationship with the United States is seen as a very important part of the Prime Minister's role. And there are some people who are, I think a considerable number of people, who are critical of Netanyahu for handling this poorly, and particularly for making Israel into more of a partisan issue within the United States. Because the Israeli strategic interest is to keep Israel a bipartisan issue in the United States, and by consistently confronting Obama,
yeah,
by appearing to favor Romney during his trip here and so forth, there is a sense, at least among the class of people who follows these things closely, that Netanyahu has tended to seek to make Israel into a partisan issue in the United States, and there's criticism of that.
No, I think that's a very interesting point, and it frankly is one that hadn't occurred to me, which is to say that taking a very long view, the ebb and flow of American politics will have one or another administration in power, but the interests of the Jewish state are that there be a consensus, a solid, durable, bilateral or multilateral, bipartisan or nonpartisan consensus about certain elemental things. Concerning the support of the Zionist project of the State of Israel, the security of the State of Israel, and that by moving the issue in the direction of it being another one of these, like abortion or, guns or, things of this kind, another one of these kind of partisan issues, an issue that could be identified with parties, you might force, whereas the Democrats in the current state might be pretty firmly pro-Israel, to the extent that this thing evolved in a sharply partisan way, you might end up drawing the issue, having the issue drawn, making it a 51-49 proposition, 52-48 proposition, and that even if you win that win in the short run, that's a less secure political foundation.
Absolutely, that's exactly it.
The longer run. I think that's a very subtle point.
That's exactly it, and particularly when you're playing to, for instance, and I'll just go back to what you said about you know, connecting it, for instance, with abortion. In particular, if you position, if an American politician, or for that matter an Israeli politician, and Netanyahu historically has done this, has positions support of Israel toward a conservative American vision, and particularly to a conservative evangelical vision, then you connect it in the public mind with cultural issues in the United States, which are obviously highly divisive, and that's a strategic mistake. Now, first of all, what that means is you don't want to connect it to partisan things. Second of all, what it means is you have to recognize that that there are other aspects of American policy, of the executive branch's policy toward Israel, which have also remained fairly consistent and bipartisan, even though people say other things in the campaign. The United States government has been opposed to settlement in the occupied territory since the first settlement was established in 1967. The United States government has interests in good relations with Arab states as well as with Israel. And that's also, you know, in the ideal situation, that's going to be bipartisan, because you don't want a situation where one party says we want good relations with the Arabs and one party says we want good relations with Israel.
But you know, the evangelical, my theory has always been that all of this Israel talk on the Republican side is not really about getting Jewish votes. There aren't that many Jewish votes for the Republicans to get at the margin, I'm guessing. And I expect that you'd probably agree with me about that. That what it's been about is about red meat for the evangelical base. And that's interesting to me, because they're... Zionism, I'm talking about the fundamentalist, conservative, theologically conservative, largely southern-based evangelical Christian electorate in the United States, is rooted in, you know, what might be regarded as some dubious theological propositions, you know. I mean, I don't know. I put that forward for your consideration, but I'm just wondering how you react to that. Israel talk in American politics today is much about Southern conservative Christian voting and the intensity of their voting as it is about Jewish folks.
Well, first of all, I think that's true. I think that it also explains why sometimes, I mean, if you look back at the Republican primaries, there were things that were said by Republican candidates that were either on the far right in Israeli terms or simply out of the spectrum in Israeli terms, you know, discussing the Palestinians as being a non-people or an imaginary people, or however it was put by some of the candidates. Santorum saying that everybody who lives in the West Bank is Israeli. I mean, these are things that just, like, you know, they're not from the real world from an Israeli perspective. They're, I assume, designed to appeal to the conservative evangelical base. I would note, by the way, that I don't think that's restricted to the South. When I was doing research for my book, The End of Days, which deals in good part with the relationship of conservative evangelicals with Israel, you know, one of the main churches I visited, for instance, was in Southern California. The region that is least part of that picture is the Northeast. Let's put it that way. But to restrict that to the Bible Belt is...
Fair enough.
A mistake. And there are certainly times when conservative groups have used Israel to excite the troops, you know, to get the grassroots going. On the other hand, that's also a little bit strange in electoral terms, because that portion of let's face it, first of all, the evangelical vote is way far away from being monolithic. That portion of the evangelical vote which is concerned with theological issues in which Israel is at play, I also don't think includes any swing voters. So where's the advantage? You know, I mean, what's the electoral gain? I mean, unless you're saying purely that it's a matter of getting out the base rather than, you know, I mean, that's the whole argument that I see about whether the election is about getting the base to vote or convincing anybody.
Well, yeah, I guess I'm going to be out on the limb here a little bit, and I'm not a political, you know, pollster operative type, so this might all be nonsense. But I guess I'm thinking it's a piece with the general sort of cultivating a general suspicion about the extent to which Obama is four square behind this American, I'm going to call it, for want of a better phrase, imperial project, the extent to which he really wants America to be sort of, you know, militarily dominant, which he wants to cheerlead for the West rather than apologize for it, you know, I mean, at the kind of fringe of the debate, this Kenyan anti-colonial mentality that one American conservative intellectual has pinned on Obama, and there's now a full-length feature film that explores the real Obama that's rooted in these ideas that he has some kind of worldview, you know. So,
all right, so I'm asking you, as somebody who's sitting there and watching this, doesn't this sound like a fantasy to you? I mean, look, first of all, I would assume that there's some frustration on the Republican side because Obama has, been successful in foreign policy. B, he has not been dovish. Ask Al-Qaeda. C, he has succeeded in creating international connections and alliances in a manner that George Bush the son didn't, but for instance George Bush the father did. So he's stolen some of the traditional, I mean, post-Vietnam,
yes,
Republican, pragmatic foreign policy space. On that level, the whole description of Obama has as being not for America is something to be explored in the psychological rather than the diplomatic realm.
I agree with that 100%, Gershom. I would not be one of those who says Obama has been soft on anything. Quite the contrary, and I think the whole thing is testimony to the durability of fictions, you know, as a part of political discourse. I mean, I think that notwithstanding the clear disparity between the reality of the Obama foreign policy and the depiction of him as somehow not fully committed with his hands on the throttle to, you know, thrusting forward, the disparity between the reality of that and some of the attacks on him are, you know, is
so I'll throw a theory out, you know, to you, and I'm doing this deliberately to be provocative, although I'm certainly not the only person to say it. I think that,
okay, go ahead,
you know, looking at this, and again, I mean, you know, to place myself, I'm somebody who grew up in America. I left America in 1977. I, you know, I'm familiar with the American scene, but I'm looking at it from the outside as an Israeli. I'm looking at it much more from the outside than from the inside. And I look at this and I see that picture of Obama as well as the birther myth and other things that have come up as being not too subtly coded statements of frustration with the idea that there is an African-American president, and that many of these issues circle around the fact that there's part of the American electorate for which America is still the white Anglo-Saxon nation and is uncomfortable with everything in America that is not that. And when people say, for instance, that Obama wasn't born in America, that's what they're saying. That's the feeling that they're expressing, and that on one level, I mean, I think this is one of the most fascinatingly sharply divided American elections that I've looked at from the outside.
Yeah.
But on one level, what's going on here is an argument about who's American. And there's one side that's saying American is multicolor, multicultural, urban, and so forth. And then there's this heartland myth. And then that's applied to foreign policy. And when it's applied to foreign policy, it turns into this bizarre anti-colonial story.
Let me react to that this way, Gershom, because I agree that there is deep discomfort and there is a cultural tectonic plate shift that's going on. We are becoming a majority-minority nation. It's a cliche to say, but it's absolutely true demographically. All kinds of stuff is happening. Republicans are a very white party. There are an older party, the Tea Party movement. Some political scientists have been looking at it and doing surveys and such. They're significantly older than the average population. Take the marriage equality debate or something like that, where what this is, you know, modernity is just coming down the track and it's going to run over these people. I mean, you know, the normalization of same-sex relationships is coming. It's inevitable. It's not going to be stopped. So there's a rearguard resistance to that. He is the first black president and so forth and so on. So I take all of that. That's all true. But I don't think that's the full story. I think that there's reason for the anxiety. So, for example, Obama, and I know how this is going to sound, and I don't want to be misunderstood. I'm about to make reference to the church that he attended for many years in Chicago and the community that he was embedded in and the sort of sensibilities of those people. And to say of someone who sits in middle America somewhere, who sees the reins of power being passed along to a generation and across a demographic divide and so on, and who wonders whether or not this new establishment and this new elite will still, you know, sort of have the same deep views and deep commitments. Now, in saying this, please, I don't want to be misunderstood. I'm not questioning the president's loyalty in any way, shape, or form. But, you know, I grew up on the south side of Chicago, and I know Jeremiah Wright's church there. Again, not to, you know, be engaging in unreasonable or unfair stereotyping of the president. Not at all. But just to say, I mean, let me just take this one issue, the issue of Israel-Palestine. Just to say, if Obama in a second term, somewhere in the deep recesses of his mind, as he contemplates the role that he plays in the sort of turning wheel of world historic event, and wants to be, quote, on the right side of history, close quote, as he thinks about his last capacities to exercise power and influence, that he might, in that imagination, in his prayer closet somewhere, you know, in his deepest recess of thought, look at the dispossession and subjugation of the Palestinian peoples with the lens of a kind of, you know, 20th, 21st century world historic wrongs to be righted or something like that, that he might see it in that way. It's not a crazy thought to me. And in fact, some of us on the left live with the hope and the prayer that he might be a little bit this Kenyan anti-colonial closeted. Not unrealistically. Not like he's going to declare for world peace or, you know, turn the reins of government over to the United Nations or anything like that. But just that at the margins that he might, you know, that he might see it a little bit differently. I mean, I pray that that would be the case, and I think that's the deepest fear of some of these conservatives. So do you see what I'm saying? I do think there's a reactionary aspect to it that's flat-out racist, but I also think there's more than a little legitimate disquiet at the uncertainties associated with this changing of the guard here in American leadership.
Okay, so let me just make three responses. I hope I remember them all. First of all, I'm consistently amused by the fact that Obama is both criticized for his church or his former church and also for being a Muslim. We'll just, you know, I mean, I'm not the first person to say that, but we'll just put that aside. The second thing is on this issue of the two visions of America, that is, in a deep sense, why I don't think that the Republican platform on Israel is going to change the historic pattern of Jews voting for the Democratic Party, because Jews are a religious and ethnic minority in the United States, and their greatest, deepest, basic interest is in a pluralistic America, and in the acceptance of difference. And I see, for instance, the gay marriage issue as also being something that at least psychologically plays to that. Are you willing to accept people who are different from you? And on that basic psychological level, I think that the Republicans are probably scaring a lot of Jews. And that they can say whatever they want about Israel. They can put Hatikva, the Israeli national anthem, in the Republican platform. They can put it in Hebrew. They can add a verse about keeping the West Bank. I think that their behavior toward difference comes across in an emotional and in a psychological way much more strongly, and that that's going to have the strongest effect on the way American Jews vote. And then there's the issue that you brought up of the Palestinians. And that gets me back to what I said before of, is this win-win or is this zero-sum? Yes, I think that, I'll put it differently. I think that it's a vital project for the United States to work toward an Israeli-Palestinian settlement. I think it's good for Palestinians. It may not provide all of their dreams. There's certainly many, if not most, Palestinians who dream is that they get all of Palestine, and they're not going to get that in the real world. It doesn't provide all of the fantasies of Israelis, but both of them will have something that is much better than the current situation. And it is in America's long-term interest in terms of creating a more stable Middle East. So I would be, I am sorry that President Obama essentially abandoned that project early on in his first term, and I very, very much hope that he comes back to that. I don't think that you have to be in some sort of anti-colonial mode or overly influenced by liberation theology. Not that I have anything particularly strong against liberation theology, but I don't think that you have to be there. I think you have to be a good diplomat to realize that good political solutions. Here I'm quoting a friend and somebody who's taught me a little bit, the former Israeli negotiator Tal Becker. A good diplomatic agreement is one in which you can imagine the victory speech that both sides is going to give after reaching the agreement. Okay? So I would say that a two-state arrangement is a victory for both Israelis and Palestinians. It's certainly a victory for American foreign policy. And I hope that domestic considerations do not prevent Barack Obama from pursuing that in his second term, assuming he's reelected.
You know, I just had a thought, and it may be truly utopian and crazy, but the thought was this. The thought was that if the Arab Spring is going to have a happy ending in the longest of long terms, I'm talking about the 25 to 50-year framework, then it will be in the form of a kind of modernization and economic development of Egypt and of the surrounding region, and a kind of integrated dynamism, economic dynamism, for which a solution to this problem, the resolution of the Palestinian claims, is an absolutely essential prerequisite. And that would have Israel, which is, you talk in one of your articles that I read about threats to future economic growth and so forth like that, playing a kind of, I don't know what, Hong Kong, super Hong Kong role to this, you know, several hundred million people coming fully into the 21st century. And that's a really kind of glorious possibility that this all of this political rubble is standing in the way of. And you know, is that, am I a madman?
Well, no, but I do want to reframe this. And here the colonial issue is very important. Sometimes Israelis express that idea of Israel sort of being the engine of development in the Middle East. And on the Arab side, there's a lot of resentment of that, because that sort of reaffirms the view of Israel as the Western power in the region trying to sort of have economic hegemony over the Arab states. So, I mean, I would like to see a better developed and more stable Middle East. I certainly hope that out of all the madness of the last couple of years, we see the development of more stable states which can pursue economic development in a way that's better for their people, that's certainly more egalitarian for their people, that can create a stable middle class in those countries and so forth. But I think that for Israel in that position, the best policy would be to be sort of very restrained, to hold back, not to sort of jump in and say, we're going to develop you.
You mean to wait and see?
No, just I'm saying there's nothing wrong with trade relations with the Arab countries and all that, but I'm just saying that the, you know, to be more specific, the sort of new Middle East vision that Shimon Peres was expressing in the 90s was taken on the Arab side as sort of an expression of
as a neo-colonialist. Yeah,
yeah. And so, you know, let's go back to the symbolic issues. You know, don't say things that step on people's old and still open wounds. And colonialism and Western exploitation are, you know, still open wounds in the Arab world. So it's not good for Israel to sort of leap up and say we'll develop you economically. It's sort of it sounds on the other side sort of like white man's burden. I don't think it's smart.
Yeah, well, maybe that's just a measure of my naivete. Yeah, I'm wondering if we have a time, Gershom, if we can talk a little bit about your amazing piece on ultra-Orthodoxy and the deep challenges both to the State of Israel and to the ultra-Orthodox community in Israel. Do you want to talk about that a bit?
I can try to do that, you know, briefly. I hope, you know, that I can explain it in a way that makes sense to people. The article is in the Prospect magazine in England, the one that you're referring to. Basically, what I was looking at is the way in which, first of all, the ultra-Orthodox community of Israel, that portion of the Orthodox Jewish community whose response to modernity has been to sort of segregate itself away from the rest of society in order to preserve a certain religious lifestyle, has become, first of all, completely economically dependent on the rest of Israel, and also, while claiming to be conservative, while claiming to preserve Judaism as it once was, is really a creation of the modern Israeli reality. And I just put that in a general framework. My research on the ultra-Orthodox, on conservative Christianity, and other religious phenomena leads me to sort of the general statement that every group that claims to be old-time religion is a very modern creation. And the ultra-Orthodox fit into that.
Old-time religion is a latter-day shtick.
Yeah, it's a modern creation. In other words, all of these movements are responding to modernity. Some of them respond to modernity in a, shall we say, reactionary fashion, an attempt to reject modernity. But in doing that, they create a photo negative. They're not what they were. Fundamentalist Christianity today is not what Christianity was 300 years ago. And Salafists or other forms of Islamic fundamentalism today are not what Islam was 300 years ago. They're new movements. And ultra-Orthodoxy is also a creation of modernity, a response to modernity.
They're new movements. They are reactionary movements in the quite literal sense
right.
of the term.
But that's a function of modernity. In the case of ultra-Orthodoxy before the State of Israel in the 19th century, sort of the principle of ultra-Orthodoxy was this statement from a Central European rabbi that everything new is forbidden from the Torah. That's a play on words on an older principle, but basically that's a brand new idea. The idea that innovation is forbidden in Judaism is an innovation, right? Okay? And then you come to the State of Israel and you have a situation where because of certain political decisions that were made that weren't measured in their consequences, that nobody expected what their consequences were, the ultra-Orthodox community in Israel developed in such a way that the accepted lifestyle for the ultra-Orthodox today is that most men spend most or all of their adult life in religious study rather than work. And that never existed in the Jewish world before.
Well, how did that come to be? Let's just focus on that for a minute. This veneration of study and the creation of this niche or occupational pursuit with the honor that comes with it. I mean, this is not an economic phenomenon. This is, seems to me, I say as an economist, a cultural phenomenon, and I'm trying to understand.
Well, it's a cultural phenomenon, but it requires an economic base. right?
Yes, it has to be paid for, indeed.
I mean, you know, all ideologies.
Why do people pay
ideologies
for?
Can only be implemented if the real conditions for them exist. If there's some way of doing it in the real world. So.
But why? Why do the Israeli public acquiesce in the transfers that are necessary to support this enterprise? What's the public meaning of the study of this sliver of the population? About 10%, do you say?
Yeah, it's a difficult. I mean, there's various statistical estimates because defining exactly who is ultra-Orthodox is, you know, I mean, you can.
Yeah.
I mean, I can read for hours the arguments between the statisticians and the sociologists about who gets counted and who doesn't. But let's just say, for the sake of argument, about 10% of at least of the Israeli Jewish population, which is 80% of the state. This did not. Nobody made a decision to create this situation. First of all, what originally happened at the early years of the state was the ultra-Orthodox community was fading, was disappearing. Its leaders were very concerned that it would fade out completely. And then at the beginning of the State of Israel, the state, as one of its first acts, passed a law for free state-supported education, which hadn't existed, for instance, in mandatory Palestine. And it implemented this through existing school systems, which included a tiny number of ultra-Orthodox schools. And what that did is it provided state funding to ultra-Orthodox elementary schools at that stage, and young women could get jobs as elementary school teachers a year or two after high school, because that's how much training you needed at the time to teach elementary school. Israel was a very undeveloped country at the time, and certain ultra-Orthodox leaders came up with this great idea that instead of men leaving their religious studies in order to get a job and get married and support their families, that they would get married younger and the wife would support them while they continued religious studies for another, say, 10 years. And this created a situation in which the state inadvertently began to foster a model in which originally young men didn't go to work. They continued in religious study. They were further socialized into their community. They got married younger. Because of this change, the marriage age dropped significantly in the ultra-Orthodox population. At the time that the state was created, 1948, the ultra-Orthodox marriage age was pretty much the same or even a little bit older than other Israeli Jews. It dropped so that it's now common for ultra-Orthodox Jews to get married by the age of 20 or a little bit afterwards. The birth rate went up. And all of this, it would have been unsustainable because in the early years when it happened, first of all, you know, around the age of 30, 35, whatever, you went out to work, and it didn't matter that you didn't have a good Western education because the country still wasn't developed, and parents had been working so they could help you out, and you came from a family with two or three or four siblings, so they didn't have that many children to help out. By the second generation, the parents were people who hadn't worked, and Israel was more developed, and economically it was becoming unfeasible. And then in 1977, just when this should have reached a crisis, Menachem Begin, the leader of the right-wing Likud, won a plurality for the first time in an election, and he needed coalition partners, and he found coalition partners from the ultra-Orthodox party at the time. And their condition was to provide all sorts of new financial support to allow the system to continue growing and developing. And you ask, how does the rest of the Israeli population acquiesce in this? Well, there's a tremendous amount of anger and frustration about it. A lot of times it's expressed most explicitly toward the fact that the ultra-Orthodox men normally receive a draft deferment as long as they're engaged in religious studies, which basically means an exemption. And that's a very sensitive topic. But the argument that I made in this article is that the draft issue is in some ways the wrong target of the discussion, because the really major threat here is that Israel cannot continue to support an ever-growing, impoverished, dependent population, and that, in fact, the ultra-Orthodox cannot continue that way, and so they have to be reintegrated into the economy, and that means probably the thing that they find or that large numbers of them find most threatening is changing their educational system so that young people receive the education they need to be integrated into what's now a developed post-industrial economy.
But now, should they be so empowered, they will likely exercise their prerogatives to move more fully into the mainstream and modern world, and to leave the community, or at least not reproduce it in the same tight-knit fashion that it has come to exist.
Well, I think that the community and today has, you know, one of the people that I, or several of the people that I interviewed for this article, young ultra-Orthodox men who are thinking this through and trying to see a different future, said, you know, this was a utopia. This totally segregated community where you spend all your time in religious study. It's what I called a, you know, a monastic society without celibacy. So it's going to be different. What ultra-Orthodoxy is today is different than what it was three generations ago, and it's going to have to change in the future. It's not going to, you know, if it has to achieve a higher degree of integration into Israeli society, into Israeli economy, it's going to look different. But the current price cap is economically unsustainable, and it's causing poverty and suffering for the people who once saw it as an ideal.
Well, I had a naive question, but I don't think I'll ask it. It's too naive. I mean, I do want to ask though about this. You say things have to change; it's not sustainable. But how can things change? I mean, that's going to be. It looks to me that will be fitful. That's going to be. I was struck in your article that I read about the extent to which some of the younger members of this community, a parent who was having his child educated in English with private funds, but didn't want his name to be known to be doing so because he feared that he might not be able to marry his children properly within the community should he be known to be somebody who was educating his child in English. Or a fellow who wanted to express his individuality by taking the uniform of the perfectly white shirt with the black trousers and so on, whatever goes with the uniform, and having his shirt be slightly off white as a, you know, sort of subtle hint of a certain amount of individuality. And I just thought, well, you know, here's a self-sustaining community of belief, commitment, loyalty, identity that exists, of course, because of public policy and all of these things that you were talking about, but also exists from the inside because of the continued adherence and reproduction of these fealties and these self-understandings, and that's in a world of the internet, in a world of transcontinental travel and all of that, that's something that's a remarkable achievement to be sustained across generations into the 21st century.
So, you know, I'll just tell you that you go, you know, for instance, to the Israeli National Library in Jerusalem, and you'll often see young ultra-Orthodox men there using the computers, and you know, on the surface, the reason is to find books in the library that are religious books, but also it's a chance to use the computer. And in fact, there's a tremendous degree of penetration of the internet into the ultra-Orthodox community, as much as the leaders are upset about that. On the one hand, I agree with you that there's a tremendous degree of social pressure and self-replication inside of the community pressing against change, and you can't really isolate yourself from the world. You can't isolate yourself from the economic factors. You can't find an island without the internet. And if, as I hope, there's change, I hope that simply is an Israeli who sees this as economically unsustainable, among other things, part of it will happen because there will be internal change, and a lot of it will probably be messy and involve a lot of conflicts and a lot of loud talking. As social change is usually
off. Just apropos of this, I saw a piece, I don't know, maybe a couple of months ago in the New York Times. It was just a little throwaway piece, but the point was that some concerns in the Orthodox community about young people's mobile phones being equipped with a text feature that allowed young people to send messages back and forth to each other that could be unmonitored, And the app or the technological fix on this was to somehow disable or limit the text functions on the mobile phones. And there was thought that this might have a market amongst American parents who were similarly concerned about the uncontrolled social consequences of instantaneous communication between adolescents. I was amused by that.
Look, you know, there's this constant fight, top-down fight in the ultra-Orthodox community to control, limit, or even to try to ban use of technology, internet, smartphones, etc., that is a channel for the penetration of outside culture into the community, a channel for open discussion and whatever. And I think, I think that it is unlikely to succeed. And I'll just add one more detail there, and then maybe we could... I'd sort of like to wrap this up, but, you know, I said before, all forms of old-time religion are modern creations, and part of that is a reaction to modernity. But the other thing is that all of the forms of old-time religion that we see around the world today have been formed and enabled by modern technology.
Irony upon irony.
Right, but I mean, I'll just go, and technology... has been a revolutionary factor in religion. Let's go back to the Gutenberg Bible. Printing totally transformed religion. The Islamic Revolution in Iran was enabled by the cassette recorder, which was also one of the major factors in the spread of fundamental Christianity in the United States at the same time in the 70s. Because you could get your message out, and you could get your message out to people to listen to on their Walkman, and they didn't have to be literate, or they didn't have to sit down and study, and the same preacher could get his message out to millions of people.
I get it. I mean, if religion is somehow the achievement of a collective mind within a community, then the capacity for inter-subjective communication, so as to form that common mind, would seem to be...
And it creates leaps, right? So I don't think that we have... I mean, I've seen good studies on the impact so far of the internet on religion. One of the early studies, really excellent, was by American sociologist Brenda Brasher. Let me think of the name. It was Give Me That Online Religion, which came out a few years ago.
Religion.
But, you know, things are continuing to move with that. Instead of the cassette recorder, you can put, you know, lessons of the entire Talmud on one iPod. There's a democratization of religion that comes out of that kind of technology, which no traditional leadership is going to control. It will be transformed by this, whether they like it or not, and I make no predictions about how that's going to happen. But anybody who thinks that, you know, just like old-time religion is a modern creation, rather than being old-time, it is also not static. It is constantly evolving. So we'll have this conversation in another 5 years, and we'll discuss what's happened in the meantime.
Gresham, so nice to talk to you. Thanks for taking the time.
It's my pleasure.